You have in front of you same handout I gave you last Sunday. And I'll be really impressed when I see someone, maybe they're here today, but I'll be really impressed when I see someone show up carrying a three-ring binder with all the handouts and the notes you've been taking in that binder. Is there one right here? Hold it up high. There's one. Because back there, all over the place. Because I'm frustrated that I'd like to have handed out every one of these verses from Romans 1:18 to the start of the 24th verse, so you all had all of them in front of you. But I have handed them all out. If you had your binder, you could turn to them. And you may say, well, you hand out the same thing every week. Well, you ought to have little different notes on it. It's like looking at a diamond from different facets. We've been covering the vast gamut of scientific exploration, from the outer reaches of space. And you that watch the news know that the media, the ceiling of this tunnel we've been talking about, that this generation, certainly in the Western world, lives in, is worse than England. The foundation of scientism, not science, scientism, that rejects God. In the words of Sagan, I've quoted many times, the popular television voice past, who would say in the series on space, on all the Discovery and Educational channels, supported by your tax dollars, by the way, the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. Now, for my tax dollars to support a man to describe the cosmos as we can see it and as it reveals itself through experiments to be, I have no quarrel with. But when my tax dollars support him to tell the world that the cosmos is all there ever was and ever will be, he became a preacher of a false doctrine religion, and I'm entitled to have my voice heard on the same tax dollars. But then they come back because the government is part of the tunnel on the left wall of, or right wall of law. Oh, that's religious and barred by the Constitution. Sagan's remark is religion. Darwinism is religion. They just would rewrite Hebrews. Now, faith is the substance of fossils hoped for and the evidence of links not seen. You want that again? Now, faith is the Christian message. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. In its place, they want us to take, now, fossils are the substance of things hoped for and the links of things not seen. Well, the links are things not seen. It's a religion. And it's a perverse religion. It is the result of a deliberate turning from the knowledge that God gives, the grace of God that allows a general revelation to all, both general in that it's available to all and general in that there's something in us that has the capacity to see that general revelation and interpret it right, and there's an absolute turning from that. Willfully, because of what Reinhold Niebuhr calls the sin of pride, an unwillingness to accept God. They don't want God. And the God that is certainly is not one they want. And I don't want to lose this message of Romans while I'm demonstrating the perversity that Paul described and proved the point that when you willingly turn from the knowledge that is available, that can lead you to God, and you trifle with it, the wrath of God is operating right now as the gospel opened up the good news of God's power to save, and righteousness being a gift from God for the simple act of trusting Him, the slow burn of God's wrath was lanced open too. And there is a wrath of God now and a wrath to come. And the wrath of God now is when God sees this deliberate turning from knowledge that He's given. I can go to other passages. We sin willfully. There's no more remission for sins. When we trifle with the knowledge of God because basically we want to be God, He turns on us, and the wrath that He gives you now is to take sense from you. A God-sense capacity that was present and available to lead you to Him, He withdraws it. And then takes an even more stringent step, turns you over to another force under the illusion that you can be free and not wanting to be under God. He turns you over to other forces that are happy to have you. And it's three times repeated in the verses to follow. God turned them over. He didn't just turn them loose. You need to understand it's not like sitting in a spaceship where there's no gravity. And you turn the bottle loose and it just floats. No. You turn the bottle loose and it goes bang. Because gravity grabs it. Many of us would like to be turned loose and just float. That's not the option. You're either held up and controlled by Him because you willingly pursue that knowledge and trust Him, or He turns you over to these other forces. Three times He says it. Now there's some words in these passages that make sure you don't lose Romans in the process of dealing with the scientific illustrations of the truth of what God says. And I'd add one footnote. Well, what's that got to do with us? Because we believe in God. It means because you have so much more light to see God's reaction to those who do not respond properly to the dim light of general revelation, how much more will He turn on you and me if we don't move ever onward in the knowledge, blessed knowledge, of the gospel that we have and the knowledge, blessed knowledge, that we must go from faith to faith. Before Paul moves on into that journey of faith to the 8th chapter and on, he issues this warning. The gospel is against the backdrop of a fed-up God. A God whose wrath is turned loose to selectively remove sense. God's sense. You're like a player that thinks the sight of himself makes every girl begin to salivate. And who simply cannot understand. Chill out and get lost, jerk. Huh? Well, I must expose myself more. Who can't believe that God is not so hungry to have you that you can pick the time and you can trifle with the knowledge you have and you can still pit yourself against his claims and he'll always be ready when you finally yield. No. There's some people that God gets fed up with your treatment of his revelation, be it general or special, and he turns off on you. And then he turns off in you the capacity to turn on to him. And then he hurls you into the hands of the seizure of sin, the world, and the devil. It doesn't pay to trifle with the knowledge you have. But I want to go through these verses and look at some words. You've got all the verses in English on the piece of paper in front of you. Others have notes. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. That's the 19th verse. Let me find that in some of the handouts that you all have. Don't run up here and give me your copy. I got one somewhere here. The 19th verse was handed out to you many, many weeks ago. Seems like months ago. Take a deep breath while I find it. There it is. Can I tell you? Because that which may be known. Now, the word there is gnoston, which is a knowledge that comes from experience. Because that which may be known about God is manifest, phaneron, manifest, for God to them, past tense, the phanerosa, manifested it to them. How did he do that? Well, let's go to the 20th verse. This is a simple statement by Paul that the wrath of God is against them for their non-God awareness, a Sabian. That was the 18th verse. An adikion, unrighteousness, and the only righteousness acceptable to God is faith, and remember that, because faith is the context of righteousness in this book. The righteousness of works is impossible, so there isn't any. Christians and sinners who are not adjudged Christians are equally sinners before the law. The only righteousness that man can do is the good news of the gospel is a new definition. And this takes us back to all the long lessons on man's search for a definition of righteousness that pleases him. When the facts are very simple, if God is, whatever he does is righteous. And as I said last Sunday, if he had a bathroom, what he does there is righteous. He's God, if he exists. What he does is righteousness. Like truth, Jesus said, when they were puzzling over truth, and he asked a question, couldn't get an answer, he says, I'm the truth. Well, you mean he doesn't come under some objective truth? Well, he did and dismissed it, fulfilled it and thus dismissed it. But that's a temporary definition of truth. He is truth. It's what he is and what he says. God, therefore, defines righteousness. And as I said the other day, well, I said something I don't want to repeat. He can define spitting as righteousness. He can define hog calling as righteousness. We can have hog calling contests. And we decide this is the best hog caller, and God said, the only ear that counts is mine. He can define it as he will. Period. And he has defined with the gospel. Righteousness is by faith. We can do faith, we can't do righteousness, but as we trust him from faith to faith, he puts his life in us, which does the righteousing. And the wrath of God is against all, a Sabian, lack of God awareness and recognition of God awareness, godliness. He's against all godlessness. And it's against unrighteousness, which in this context is lack of faith, and against all of those who have this state of godlessness and no faith in him, and who, got a cone tone, hold down, grasp and hold to suppress the truth. In their wickedness, their lack of righteousness, their lack of trust, they seek to hold the truth down. And that was the prelude to this verse. Because it's a suppression of truth that they know, because that which may be known about God, experienced about God, is manifest in them. How? Next verse. Am I boring you? 120. Where in the world is that? You got it in your binders? 120. For the invisible things. That's an interesting word. The root of it is the word or verb, and they even have on this the wrong root, really. It's a word you can find in Strong's Concordance, and they have the number underneath it. But the real root is the word for visible. Ho. Ro. We write it in English letters. Now it looks like a D that I wrote there, but it's O with the reverse. It gives it the aspirate sound. Ora'o. Ho-ra'o. Which is visible. Now what we have here is in front of the word, you that have the handout that I gave on that day, you have in front of it, ah. Orata. Now what does ah do to it? It's that negative particle that reverses it. Right? So the ah, and then it's the particular tense form, aorata, that which is not visible. I want you to see that because the words are twisted sort of in the English and it's not made as clear when you read the King James, which is why you need these notes kept with you all the time. But the King James says, "For that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them." No, for the not visible, and things should not even be brought into it. We're not talking about things here. We're talking about the not visible God. Understand that? So that which may be known of God, in that sense, the King James is right, because they didn't translate that which may be known of the things of God. We're not talking about the things of God. Understand me? For that invisible or not seen of God from the creation of the worlds by the things made, poiemasa, the things that find there, the invisible of God from the creation of the world by the things made, which is the creation, the same thing that the scientists study, and then it becomes scientism because they say the only way to find truth, the only place to find truth is this cosmos. That's the only place you're going to find it because that's all that there is. And the only way to find it is the scientific method. There's no other way to truth, which obviously rules the Bible out because it's revelation, not a product of scientific experimentation. Scientism rules out any method to approach truth but their experimental method. And the only place you can find truth is in the things of this world that are seen. And I talked about the tunnel, that's the foundation. Education embraced that through John Dewey's progressive education. The law embraced it, beginning with the Scopes trial. And the media is still on it because I heard him parroting, and I started to say this earlier. You saw him shoot off a rocket. How many saw it on news? They're telling you it's going to the outer reaches of space, where it will find evidence of that echo of the Big Bang that happened 15 to 20 billion years ago. Anybody see that on TV? It will pick up things that may or may not support the theory of the Big Bang. It's fact. It's fact. Nobody in their right mind would question it. Oh, you can hold this religious, poetic, mystical, emotional release that you get in religion, and it's in this country we tolerate it. The Constitution separates it from the state, and the state is all of us who have sense, and you are the separated ones that are sort of more and more becoming the freak show, like the Amish, who bundle and ride in horse-drawn carriages on Pennsylvania Turnpike. And if you kill one of them, you'll be punished with 50 hangings because you've removed a spectacle of our tolerance. So weird, anybody knows it's crazy. But look, we put up with crazy people like that. Oh, they never say it like that. We even make movies of the Amish and use a superstar to portray them. They're like a restored Plymouth village that people visit as an oddity and make it look like a idyllic life, when in reality the teeth were falling out and they were dying between 30 and 40. Oh, to be a Puritan in the beauty and virginity of early America. The arrow hits you and the scalp is peeled off. But media told all of us, they're going out there, you may not like what you find, they're going to find the evidence of the beginning of the Big Bang. That's taken for granted. And yet God says, there is a manifestation outside them and in them for the aorata, the not seen of God, from the creation of the world by the things made. And there's a very important tie-in of two words here that I have to take the time to do before we move on. How many have got in front of you this Romans 1:20 and can see the Greek word translated being understood? No umena. How many see that? No umena katharatai or katharatai. Those are the two words. Being understood, no umena, and are clearly seen. Kath Oratai. Is that what you see? How many got your hands up looking at that page of 120? Most of you don't have it because you didn't hand it out today, but you kept your notebook, you'd all have it. Can I say that again? If you kept your study book and had your notes in front of you, easy carry your passes in it, you'd all have this in front of you. And I could refer back to it. And you are the envy of all the people who watch you on TV that periodically say, can we have copies of those things you hand out? And the answer is no, you got to come here to get them. But well, we live 3,000 miles away. Get on a plane. I want you to understand there are two words here, really three words. See what the root word is down under no umena? Now, I understand. And I'm not suggesting you have to learn to read Greek and to master that language in order to be a Christian. That's what the pastor is supposed to be able to do for you. And the reason I hand it out is so, not that you're going to memorize and remember all this, you can see with your own eyes. I mean, how many times do you hear a guy that can't even spell his own name in English say, the Greek says this? You ever heard that? Well, the Greek says this. Well, growing up as a boy, I had that urge to show me. And that's what I'm doing. And once you see it, aha! You don't need to see it again. You don't need to remember it. I then can make the application, which is critical, lest you succumb to that evil spirit of thinking, well, now, wait a minute. I don't understand how God can do this. It doesn't seem fair. Well, he doesn't have to be fair. But I think when I finish, you'll see he is. That's why I want to do this. There are three words here. See the root under no umena? It's noeo. This O with the long O. That's O with, in the Greek, this is O, ah, sometimes, and this is O, long O. Not so complicated. In the English, we have O, and then we have sometimes a line across it that lets us know you pronounce it the way you do in the alphabet, with a long, strong O. This is noeo, the verb-based form. This word, katharatai, you will miss it if I don't pull it apart. And underneath it, it's got the wrong word here, which takes you to the Strong's, and then Strong's will tell you something when you go there. He'll tell you to go, if you're writing down, and you have Strong's, how many have Strong's dictionaries? Well, they're telling you down here, you go to the Greek section of Strong's Dictionary, 2529, to find this word katharao. But it also tells you to go to 2596, because the katho part of this is from kata, which is a particle preceding. Kata is 2596, and ho ra'o, 3708, which is the same word here, visible. So this word, and this should be zoom out rather, this word katharoktai is based on two words, kata and hora'o, linked together in the particular syntax form of the word katharoktai. So it's two words. So now we want to trace kata, hora'o, and noeo. And I'm going for the door. But let me explain why. Now kata, I'm going to make a word up since we're talking Greek anyway. I've told you, like, I'll reverse these things. Oh, kata tends to ultimatize things. And down. Like in the famous Corinthian passage about communion, you have the krema, temporary judgment, if you don't discern the Lord's body as you partake. And that is a gracious act of God to give us this wake-up call of temporary krema, punishment, so that we not get kata krema, the ultimate punishment of the world. Now, in the King James, they just use condemned and damned and damnation and never distinguish between krema, which is temporary, going on if you don't discern at the table of the Lord, and katakrama, which the krema is trying to save you from, ultimate damnation, ultimate judgment. Here is a pushing to an ultimate, a digging down deep. The ultimate seeing, an ultimate kind of seeing, a visible, that is seeing something that is ultimately visible but down deep underneath. Following that? It's like that word that has the evil people holding back the truth. The same word is used for holding fast something that you should hold. So it can be used positively or negatively. Kata krema, judgment down to the ultimate. Kata horao is seeing deep. The ultimate perception that goes beyond just the first glimpse. Now, follow me closely, then we get into the funny stuff. Okay? For the aorata, not seen, with a in front of this word. You still with me? Horao is to see. In the verb form here, it's put with a negative particle, a horao. It's not seen. So the not seen of God from the creation of the worlds by the things made, the things science is working on, by those, what was that?
Part of the camera.
Part of the camera. I didn't think anybody was back there shooting at me. Are you awake? I am. The not seen, and there's only one subject about not things. There's lots of not seen things. We've already proven that the universe is made up 99% of nothing. Right? And nobody's ever seen an electron. Nobody's ever seen an atom. But we're not talking about those things. We're talking about the not seen God. The not seen of God by the things He made. The translation is, are clearly seen. But you notice there's an additive factor. Noeo is linked with Kapha Ratai. Noeo is not linked with the invisible. This leakage, now I could spend the whole hour in this message, go to, if you don't want to believe me, go to the most authoritative books on the subject today. There's nothing to match in New Testament Greek analysis, the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. I've taken you there more than once. And if I can just scan it for a second without getting bogged down, just to support what I'm saying, they make a big deal out of the fact that this clearly seen, being understood or clearly seen, in the Greek, if you look on that piece of paper, they have to put numbers there to make you make sense of the sequence if you translate it into English. You see that? I mean, because the literal is, the four, invisible of Him from creation, world, by the things made being understood, clearly seen, both everlasting, His power, and you have numbers that tell you how to put it in a sequence you can translate into English, right? How many see that on your paper? But the Greek, just like the English, which is why some languages cannot be translated straight across. You know, in the English language, two words that stand independent and alone, when linked together beside each other, is like, how about the Espanol people? You put the word which translates in English grand in front of lady or man, it has a different meaning than if you put it after the word. I mean, depending upon whether it's in front of man or woman or behind man or woman, you're saying a big, large person, or you're saying a great person. Right? You, how many Latinos will say, hey, correcto? Is that correct? And where you put grand or grande determines whether you're saying the person is fat or famous. And there is a difference. Whether you're saying they're big or great. Now, you can't just translate the words literally straight across into English. The Greek is the same. I'm not even going to read this book. You believe me? When you link horao, which is seeing, and I could go to the same book, and in the ancient Greek, which was picked up by the Bible, they have, by comparison, a limited number of words for hearing. Seeing and hearing were the two prominent senses to the Greeks that were the birthplace of the language that matriculated through the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament and was the language of the New Testament world. And I think in the fullness of time, God sent His Son, the Word Eternal, because that language was so precise. This language in the Greek links words, and the words that are being linked here are very carefully chosen by God who inspired Paul. I repeat, hearing and seeing were the most prominent. We've already dealt with the word akouo, The hearing of faith. You remember that? The hearing of faith, which in the earlier messages has been reduced down and robbed of its meaning to the obedience of faith. But if obedience still meant what it meant in the original, which is to run forward, and deans from the Latin language stream, desire, and all the other words that mean to say, it's to run toward the sayer, so it's okay. It's the hearing of faith that runs toward the sayer. But language changes as it rolls along. In the Greek, only a few words for hearing, and the prominent one was akouo. But pages of different words for seeing. Many different words for seeing. And each of those words have a specific twist or facet of meaning different than the others. Seeing, to the Greeks, who produced art and sculpture, seeing, to them, required language refinement to be very specific. And in this case, when they link noeo, which is, I will read this, very simple. Don't have to read a lot about noeo. Where's my reading glasses now? Over here. Noeo helps when you turn it right side up. The verb noeo, literally, to direct one's mind to a subject. To perceive, to notice, in the sense of receiving sensual impressions, but working on it with the mind. Claimed by philosophical use for the sense to know, to grasp, to think. The verb comes to be understood in a mental sense and they even go to illustrate dealing with Romans 1:20. In Romans 1:20, Paul explains the fact of a revelation of God accessible to all men through which, and he quotes the verse in the Greek, the invisible God is seen as contemplation of his works directs the mind to their author. From that which is before him, the meaningful order of the universe and its course, man can and should work back to him who gives it meaning and recognize not only his existence but also his nature. The paradox, ta aorata, the not visible, katharatai, is removed by the noumena. Here then, the noein or noeo can denote only a purely intellectual process, attentive thought which takes note of what is seen and by means of which the observer apprehends and understands what is before him. I go on, as I said, on these words ad infinitum. When you link the mind and place it exactly in front of, even though it makes a very awkward translation. You following me? They had to change it. Understood. Let me tell you how they rearranged it. You that have it in front of you already see it. For the invisible things of him, from is the next word. That's got a number two on it. Because you got to go clear down to katharatai, are clearly seen, from the world's creation by the things made, being understood by the things made. So you are many words away. Noumena comes after, in the English, rearrangement, katharatai, and it comes four or five words later after. I could read from another one. What a miserable translation does. It's sensible translation, but how it totally aborts the meaning of the Greek. Because the mind activity had to happen immediately before or simultaneous with the sight activity. For that which is seen to be given the deeper meaning of a mind that is not turned off by God, that mind that everybody is given as a gift from God, looking at the creation and the things made. When the mind responds properly to those things seen, it will see more deeply. This watch requires a watchmaker. You follow what I'm saying? And in the Greek, the very positioning of the verb noeo in front of the ultimate seeing, horata, guarantees the meaning that a mind application added to what is seen is the kind of clearly seen, understood meaning that is there. Otherwise, somebody calls it an oxymoron, where you state opposites to make a point. No, the invisible, he, by the things made, when the mind looks at it and says to himself, there's no explanation, there must be a creator. You have come to a deeper truth. And God is saying, that's the only conclusion he allows. He gave you a mind. He gave you the capacity to deduce. This cannot be without a maker. And to rebel against that, as I have said, modern scientism will not even allow that as an alternative. God must be ruled out completely. He cannot even have a part. God is saying, I made all this. And I manifested myself to the whole world, to anybody but a moron. This cannot happen by chance. When the mind is applied to what is seen, and when you in the modern science world go beyond the first century Pauline Christians, that the further we have probed, Francis Crick, wrestling with the fact that evolution just simply cannot explain the spontaneous birth of life. And the Miller-Urey experiment is in an atmosphere that never existed on Earth. A prestigious Darwinist proposes pangenesis, that some other life form in the universe planted the seeds of life here. Well, that didn't do anything. We just transfer the problem out there. How did it start? The Big Bang was grabbed by the Christians because it presupposes the starting point. So who was the banger? And I've already said, fossils are the substance of things hoped for and the evidence for links not seen. They've never found the missing links. We've gone through their icons that are being asked that we worship. I mean, behold your fossils that brought you out of Egypt. The golden calf of the Israelites. We have gone through weeks of showing the further they look, the more questions are raised. And the further you go into the... And, you know, I sort of feel as I'm preaching this as though there's some kind of lateral positioning of the mind that we think, well, there's this micro world down to quarks and soup and photons and electrons that cannot even be looked at without affecting their position or their motion. And then there's these giant supernovas and the galaxy. No. Every part of the universe reduces down to these quarks and subatomic particles. The earth I'm standing on, including this platform, but everything, is constant movement. They tell us. And there's enough experimentation to suggest that's the case. Well, who? To them, I would ask, who in hell is ordering all this? Everything they teach you is nuts. The absolute unchanging rules from Newton on, the two main first and second principles or laws of thermodynamics. First, the conversion of energy. Energy never disappears, it's just converted. Energy to mass, mass to energy. Where did the first energy come from? What's the first energy source? And as I said, who was the banger? Second law of thermodynamics. With the arrow of time, decay and entropy, not order and organization. And evolution postulates uniformitarianism. Things have always been as they are. Massive evidence of cataclysms. Everything on a factual basis has been blown apart. But they're not true scientists. They look for that and this and that and this other that supports their a priori faith. Fossils are the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of links not seen. Why do they do this? Because they don't like God. They don't want God. They don't want His sovereignty. I already told you about R.C. Sproul. Atheism is a state of mind. You don't want a sovereign. Adam and Eve wanted the garden without God, without restriction. You don't want a boss. You want to be the boss. You want to be God. That's the problem of the scientists. They want to be the creator of that which is worshipped. They want to be the master. If they can understand it, as Stephen Hawking says, I'm the master of it. They don't like a God who's sovereign. They don't want a God who's sovereign. They want God not to be. They don't want a God who's holy. Now, many times I've demonstrated, hagios, the word for saint, has to do not with performance, but with position. Righteousness has to do with performance, and the way of faith, God is the righteouser. He does the performing, we do the trusting. A saint is one who commits himself. It is a transferal of sphere into a sphere where we are His. But that sphere has deeper meanings when applied to God. The angels in Isaiah 6 surround the throne and sing, Holy, holy, holy. The Hebrew word is translated hagios, hagios, hagios. And the word in both the Hebrew and the Greek means that which is separate, unpresentable of ourself in front of, which must be walled away from us because, as Isaiah said, as the angels were singing this and he saw God sitting on a throne high and lifted up, woe is me, I am undone, a man of unclean lips, dwell in the midst of an unclean people. We don't like to have to deal with someone that intimidates us by his worthiness, by His otherness, that ultimate other, by that which we have to face we are not, and helpless in front of can only be, if He deigns to grace us with the presence of His life that is in the process of making us like Him. We don't like the intimidation and the awe that must come and the glory that is due Him. We don't like that. It intimidates. We don't like His omniscience because we can't fool Him. We can lie to ourselves, we can lie to everybody else, but we can't lie to Him. And I could go through a long psychological study I read this week of how we compensate. And one of the ways we compensate is getting more religious. A religious of our own kind that elevates us and that we feel like the Pharisees. We've reduced God down to our standard and His ultimate otherness. My bones begin to melt, one prophet said, at the sight of God. We don't like that. We don't like His omniscience. He knows everything about us. You can't fool Him. And these people, as another verse says, with their skillful dialogues and their self-exalting, self-serving, Matthias is the word, vain dialogues, elevate themselves. They sit supreme in the tunnel of today's world as the high priests of knowledge. When inside, they're just like the Pharisees that Jesus talked about. Outside, you're like a sepulcher painted white on the outside, but inside you're full of all men's dead bones. I'm like, to believe there's a God we can't fool. And as Jonathan Edwards, the great preacher of New England, said, we don't like His immutability. We can maybe live a while with His sovereignty, His holiness, His omniscience, but maybe we can outlast Him, and a time will come when He'll change, and it won't be such a difficult person to deal with. No, He's immutable. I'm God, and I change not. You must always come to confront that God, and that's what the scientists don't want. And they will do anything to keep from recognizing the possibility. But God says, I made it manifest. I put in them the capacity, the nous, the mind, which is the noun form, to do the thinking, noeo, that if they would apply their brain to what is made, it tells them, it speaks, as one of the Old Testament passages says, it speaks of a creator. No, 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 no. Because that makes me bow to sovereignty, holiness, omniscience, and immutability. I want to be God. So get Him off the page. And God says, I gave you the mind. I made the watch. You don't even accept it as an option that there's a watchmaker. So I'm taking the ability out of your mind, which was a gift, to even see me. And I'm turning you over to forces that don't give a damn whether you have a mind or not. Indeed, it will become a perverse mind, as the later verses say. You want an illustration? That's what I've been doing, is trying to show you illustrations of the truth of what God said, that people as intelligent as these scientists that probe the depths in every direction, and only as they dig deeper does the conclusion suggest itself even more if the mind is not perverted. Oh, the wonder of it. The wonder of what Thou hast made. This is their attitude. Let's take the atheist philosopher Norwood Russell Hansen. He says, this shows you the perversity. I'm not a stubborn guy. I would be a theist, believe in God, under some conditions. I'm open-minded. Okay? Okay? The conditions are these. Suppose next Tuesday morning, just after breakfast, all of us in this one world are knocked to our knees by a percussive and ear-shattering thunderclap. Snow swirls, leaves drop from trees, the earth heaves and buckles, buildings topple, towers tumble. The sky is ablaze with an eerie, silvery light. And just then, as all of the people of this world look up, the heavens open, the clouds pull apart, revealing an unbelievably radiant and immense Zeus-like figure towering over us like 100 Everests. He frowns darkly as lightning plays over the features of his Michelangeloid face, and then he points down at me and explains to every man, woman, and child to hear, quote, "I've had quite enough of your too clever logic chopping and word watching in matters of theology. Be assured, Norwood Russell Hansen, that I do most certainly exist." He's not a stubborn guy, he's open-minded. It chills you, doesn't it? You don't know whether to laugh or pray. That's their attitude. These are the terms where I will believe in you. Of course, you notice he had to, with all the world suffering this marvelous and wondrous display, he had to be the center of attention. He spoke to me. I'm going to bore you by reading from a little book, The Collapse of Evolution, by Scott M. Hughes. The most widespread and influential argument against the veracity of the Bible is the all too common belief that modern science has proven evolution, thereby discrediting the scriptural account of creation. The fatal flaw in this argument, however, is the fact that it's impossible to prove scientifically any theory of origin. This is because the very essence of the scientific method, properly understood, is based upon observation and experimentation, and it's impossible to make observations or conduct experiments on the origin of the universe. And yet millions, billions of dollars just sent this thing off. I don't mind it going off. I like the exploration. I don't care about my tax dollars being spent for that. What I get insulted at is some beanhead commentator telling me they're going to discover the origin of the universe. The point is conceded by British biologist L. Harrison Matthews in the foreword. They don't put this in your textbooks. To the 1971 edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. Quote, "The fact of evolution is the backbone of biology, and biology is thus in the peculiar position of being a science founded on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith? Belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither up to the present has been capable of proof." It's using the mind based upon observation. That's faith. Now, I could take you to Hebrews 11:3. Some of you have that in your notebook. You'll find in Hebrews 11:3, faith is linked to this act of creation. I can find this in a hurry. I really want to point it out. You got Hebrews 11:3 in your notebook, folks? Who on the front seats got their notebook open to it? It was attached to one of the Romans 1:23. Anybody close to me here on the front got it? Here it is, I got it. Last page down here. By faith, pistis, we understand. Same verb. No. Amen. Same verb. By faith we understand to have been created the worlds by the Word of God, so as not from visible things, phanomenon, to seeing, to have come to be. The things seen were not made from visible things, but from nothing were made to come to be. And the mind, activated by faith, perceives the creation came into being by the Word of God. And faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. So when you're exposed to spatial revelation, it brings forth faith, and by faith we understand that this creation was made by the Word of God. Because He says so. But before they have been exposed to special revelation and have heard the Word of God, which springs faith forth, God holds them accountable for a mind that He gave a unit of something in it that could, among the alternatives, deduce there's an unseen hand behind this. But they don't want. And then they go the next step of being perverse and convincing the world that they have facts. For example, Sir Julian Huxley, grandson of Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley. The first point to make about Darwin's theory of evolution is it's no longer a theory, but a fact. No serious scientist would deny the fact that evolution has occurred, just as he would not deny the fact that the earth goes around the sun. M.J. Kinney has stated, of the fact of organic evolution, there can be, at the present day, no reasonable doubt. The evidence is for it so overwhelming that those who reject it can only be the victims of ignorance or prejudice. Professor George Gaylord Simpson, Darwin finally and definitely established evolution as a fact. The American Association for the Advancement of Science recently stated, 100 million fossils identified and dated in the world's museums constitute 100 million facts that prove evolution beyond any doubt whatsoever. Fossils are the substance of things hoped for, and the links of things not seen. I could go on, but I think I've covered enough and brutally handled the facts, that the facts are not as factual as they appear. Right? We don't have enough. Now, let's go on. I want to show you something. Biology is the basis. The basis, primarily. The geologic column, other things support it because of the a priori commitment. This is the way it must have happened. But biology is the home ground for evolution. And information theory and molecular science, particularly genes and DNA, have progressed now, as with all other areas, to where even more than in Paul's day, the hand of a creator is obvious. The world in which we live is truly an amazing and wondrous place. It is home to a cheetah cat that can run 70 miles an hour, insects which can sleep for 17 years, Weddell seals that can remain underwater for 45 minutes, diving to depths of 1,500 feet, eight-armed, ink-shooting octopuses that can eat their own arms and grow new ones, archer fish that can shoot water 15 feet into the air and hit a bug, peregrine hawks that can swoop down on their prey at 150 miles an hour, and so on. The earth does indeed contain a myriad of highly complicated and intricate adaptations which completely defy evolutionary explanation. Nature is simply teeming with innumerable examples of ingenious design and purpose. Purposiveness, and the idea of purpose and design in the living world is known as teleology. God or someone directed it. One of the most, well, George Gallup, not that he's the greatest scientist, but originated a well-known opinion polls, he understands statistics, once remarked that he could prove God's existence statistically. Take the human body alone, the chance that all the functions of the individual could just happen is a statistical monstrosity. Evolutionists are hard-pressed to explain the step-by-step accidental development of the human eye. And this takes us into information theory. And I think I remember reading in an earlier message how a scientist describes what happens when the photons hit your eyes. Charles Darwin himself acknowledged the utter inadequacy of evolutionary theory when attempting to account for a structure such as an eye developing by chance. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. You ever heard Darwin saying that in a textbook? The belief that an organ as perfect as the eye could have formed by natural selection is more than enough to stagger anyone. And there are different kinds of eyes. For example, the trilobite eye. This is in support of what information theorists say could not happen by chance. The cells, the DNA, that have the information already programmed in them to produce these varied species. And the Bible said, after their kind. And the links are hoped for, but there has never been a fossil found that is links of another kind. They postulate the punctuated equilibrium theory I told you about, and the hopeful monster where some reptile lays an egg and out comes a bird. They've never found and never will find, other than reproduce after their kind. The DNA's got the formula written in. There may be deviations within the kind, like the breeding of dogs and flowers. You don't breed flowers and produce cheetahs. You don't breed reptiles who lay eggs and produce birds. The trilobite eye, extinct now, the trilobite nevertheless speaks to us concerning ingenious design and purposeness in nature. Unlike the lens of a human eye, and these soft particles have been fossilized, which absolutely requires an instant pressure, not a slow, uniform laying down of deposits. Soft body deposits would be eaten, decay. It took instant fossilization. Unlike the lens of a human eye, which is composed of living organic tissues, trilobite eyes were composed of inorganic calcite. Consequently, many trilobite lenses have been preserved in the fossil record, allowing paleontologists to study them. What they've discovered is truly impressive. Unlike human eyes, which are composed of a single lens, trilobite eyes have a very spatial double lens design with anywhere from 100 to 15,000 lenses in each eye, depending on the subspecies. This spatial design allowed the trilobites to see underwater perfectly without distortion. Implicit knowledge of Avicenne law, Fermat's principle, and various other principles of optics are inherent in the design of these lenses. They appear to have been carefully designed by a very knowledgeable physicist, and indeed the creationists would agree. They were. One of the most intriguing mysteries among marine creatures is found in the truly, this is supposed to have happened by chance, according to Darwinism. One of the most intriguing mysteries among marine creatures found in the truly remarkable sea slug. The sea slug lives along the seacoast within the tidal zone where it feeds primarily on sea anemones. Sea anemones are not exactly the most inviting of dinners, as they're equipped with thousands of small stinging cells on their tentacles, which explode at the slightest touch, plunging poisoned harpoons into would-be intruders. The spirit intruder is paralyzed and drawn into the anemone's stomach to be digested. Although this is a defense system, the remarkable sea slug is nevertheless able to eat sea anemones without being stung, exploding the stinging cells, or digesting them. One of the most fascinating mysteries in nature is what the sea slug does with the poor anemone stinging cells. The undigested stinging cells are swept along through ciliated tubes, which are connected to the stomach and end in pouches. The stinging cells are arranged and stored in these pouches to be used for the sea slug's defense. And so whenever the sea slug is attacked, it defends itself using the stinging cells which the ill-fated anemone manufactured for its own protection. God must have had fun. The highly complicated series of modifications that would have had to occur to produce this incredible relationship that completely defies evolutionary explanation. First of all, in order to prevent the stinging cells from exploding, the sea slug would have had to evolve some kind of chemical means to temporarily neutralize them before he ate the first one. The sea slug would also have to evolve a new digestive system which would digest the tissues of the anemone but not the stinging cells. The sea slug would also have to cleverly evolve the sophisticated ciliated tubes and pouches, as well as a highly complex mechanism for arranging, storing, and maintaining the stinging cells. Finally, and contrary to evolutionary expectations, the anemone would have to endorse the sea slug's plans by refraining from evolving countermeasures. Obviously, there's no satisfactory evolutionary explanation for the existence of such extraordinary adaptive design. The only reasonable explanation for this fascinating relationship is that these organisms were specifically created and carefully designed by their creator to fit into their respective ecological niches. Another fascinating, this all evolved by chance. Survival of the fittest, mutations, chance mutations, and all of a sudden, another fascinating relationship which has been observed in nature concerned the bull's horn acacia tree of Central and South America. This tree is furnished with large hollow thorns that are inhabited by a species of ferocious stinging ants. Small bumps on the tree also supply food to the ants. Consequently, the ants get food and shelter from the tree. Why don't they just stay there? The tree, for its part, receives complete protection from all animal predators and plant competitors. The ants viciously attack any and all intruders. But the truly remarkable aspect of this symbiotic relationship is the fact that these ants are gardeners. They make regular raids in all directions from their home tree, nipping off every green shoot that dares to show its head near the tree. As a result, this particular tree always had plenty of sunlight and space, which is a rarity in the tropical jungle where the competition for such things is intense. Experiments have shown that when all the ants are removed from one of these trees, the tree dies within 2 to 15 months. Evolutionists casually label this type of symbiotic relationship as an example of co-adaptation. Well, let's try this one. An amazing relationship found in nature which ridicules evolutionary thinking is that of cleaning symbiosis. Fish, for example, roam about feeding on smaller fish and shrimp, only to find that their mouths have become littered with debris and parasites. The solution to this problem for several types of fish is a visit to the local cleaning station. At the cleaning station, the large fish opens its mouth and gill chambers, bearing vicious-looking teeth, and in swim the undaunted little cleaner fish and shrimp to do their jobs. After their chores completed, they swim back out of the larger fish's mouth unharmed, and the big fish swims away. It is obvious that all parties involved benefit from this relationship, but this does not explain the origin and development of this special relationship. Survival value can only be used as an argument after a relationship has been established. The picture is further complicated for the evolutionists by the fact that several species of predatory fish, cleaner fish, and shrimp were involved in this operation. Creationists maintain that this type of relationship could never have resulted from a mere chance. Trial and error evolutionary process. Animal instincts for self-preservation would surely override any such unnatural, suicidal tendency. Also, the temptation to get an easy free meal or to react to the irritating cleaners would tend to discourage the development of such a relationship. This type of arrangement can only reflect special creation. It should also be noted that cleaning symbiosis is by no means limited to fish alone. Amazingly enough, there is a bird, the Egyptian plover, that is willing to walk right into the mouth of Nile crocodiles to clean out parasites. He too leaves completely unharmed. Oh, the wonders of God's creation. Well, now wait. This one is God's way, I'm sure, who knows the future. They must be laughing in heaven over this bomb, pun intended, they threw in the evolutionary theory's workplace. Do you ever notice how sometimes big surprises can come in little packages? Well, such is the case of the surprising little bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle is a small insect that is armed with an impressive defense system. Whenever threatened by an enemy attack, this spirited little beetle blasts irritating and odious gases, which are at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, out from two tailpipes right into the unfortunate face of the would-be aggressor. Oh, you know, some of us could have used that if God hadn't just given it to the beetle. Hermann Schillnet, a German chemist, studied the bombardier beetle to find out how he accomplishes this impressive chemical feat. He learned that the beetle makes his explosive by mixing together two very dangerous chemicals, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide. In addition to these two chemicals, this clever little beetle adds another type of chemical known as an inhibitor. The inhibitor prevents the chemicals from blowing up and enables the beetle to store the chemicals indefinitely. Whenever the beetle is approached by a predator, such as a frog, he squirts the stored chemicals into the two combustion tubes, and at precisely the right moment, he adds another chemical, an anti-inhibitor. This knocks out the inhibitor, and a violent explosion occurs right in the face of the poor attacker. Could such a marvelous and complex mechanism have evolved piecemeal over millions of years? The evolutionist is forced to respond with a somewhat sheepish yes. But a brief consideration of this viewpoint will reveal its preposterous nature. According to evolutionary thinking, there must have been thousands of generations of beetles improperly mixing these hazardous chemicals in fatal evolutionary experiments, blowing themselves to pieces. Eventually, we are assured they arrived at the magic formula. But what about the development of the inhibitor? There's no need to evolve an inhibitor unless you already have the two chemicals you're trying to inhibit. On the other hand, if you already have the two chemicals without the inhibitor, it's already too late, for you've just blown yourself up. Obviously, such an arrangement would never arise apart from intelligent foresight and planning. Nevertheless, let us assume that the little beetles somehow managed to simultaneously develop the two chemicals along with the all-important inhibitor. The resultant solution would offer no benefit at all to the beetle, for it would just sit there as a harmless concoction. To be of any value to the beetle, the anti-inhibitor must be added to the solution. So once again, for thousands of generations, we're supposed to believe these poor beetles mixed and stored these chemicals for no particular reason or advantage until finally the anti-inhibitor was perfected. Now he was really getting somewhere. With the anti-inhibitor developed, he could now blow himself to pieces. This guy writes funny. With the anti-inhibitor developed, he can now blow himself to pieces, frustrating the efforts of the hungry predator who wants to eat him. Yes, he still needs to evolve the two combustion tubes. Yes, and a precision communications and timing network to control and adjust the critical direction and timing of the explosion. You don't want it to go off in the tubes. So here we go again. For thousands of generations, these carefree little beetles went around celebrating the 4th of July by blowing themselves to pieces. By blowing themselves to pieces until finally they mastered their newfound powers with two tailpipes. But what would be the motivation for such disastrous trial and error piecemeal evolution? Everything in evolution is supposed to be beneficial and have a logical purpose, or else it would never develop. But such a process does not make any sense, and to propose that the entire defense system evolved all at once is simply impossible. Yet nature abounds with countless such examples of perfect coordination. Thus, we can only conclude that the surprising little bombardier beetle is a strong witness for special creation, for there's no other rational explanation for such a wonder. The water beetle is also equipped with an impressive, though different, defense mechanism. He manages to escape his enemies by secreting a detergent substance from a gland. Injecting the detergent accomplishes two things. First, it serves to propel the beetle forward quickly so he's out of immediate danger. Secondly, the detergent causes the surface tension of the water to break down and the pursuing insect sinks into the water. How true are the words of the psalmist who wrote, O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. Psalm 104:24. And that's my message. Your reservations today early, please. And it is offering time. I can't think of a better song. You got to have faith. Faith in the Creator who made it all. I hope you are beginning to see the danger of just pushing God out of the sphere of your life. Thanks be to God for His grace to those of us who trust Him and see His hand in creation. He puts His life in us, does the righteous thing. All we got to do is keep trusting. And I sure have proof that it works. Hallelujah. faith. Good day, folks.